You're in tune to KZSU Stanford. It's time for another edition of Raising Sand.
Welcome to another edition of Raising Sand Radio. I'm your host, Susan Gallimore, and today it's my great pleasure to introduce Dr. Eric Kamaid, who, since 1985, has been a federally certified court interpreter practicing in 8 states. He also teaches Spanish at Florida International University. Dr. Kamaid was one of the 26 interpreters hired for approximately 300 undocumented workers, the majority from Guatemala and Mexico, arrested in a surprise raid by 900 Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents, that's ICE agents, at a kosher meat processing plant in Postville, Iowa on May 12, 2008. Postville's population is a bit more than 2,000, so this mass arrest made a deep impact on the town and its residents. Dr. Kamaid was one of the few people who came in direct contact with those arrested. Today we'll hear his insider account of the raid. I started by asking Dr. Kamaid to describe his other work in Iowa and how this case was different.
I've had been to Iowa several times before to do trials of usually involving drug traffickers. This time around, they called me about a month ahead, and they told me that the court was planning to do a continuity of operations exercise in case their normal operations were ever disrupted by an emergency, like floods or something of that nature, so that they could ensure that they could continue operating. And as a result, they were moving the court operations for 2 weeks to a remote location, and there they were going to have real cases. Now, when I arrived, there were another 25 federal interpreters from all over the country who had been flown in. We're all told the same thing. And then the next day when we reported to the National Cattle Congress, which was the compound where a makeshift court had been set up and where the detainees were being kept after the raid the previous day, we found out what it was all about, that the day before, Monday, May 12th at 10 in the morning, there had been a large immigration raid, and we were told that they were keeping about 400 detainees there at the compound. And then they gave us a cursory tour of the compound, which was a cattle fairgrounds. It had like a large ballroom where the makeshift court had been set up, and fenced in behind it, there were 23 trailers from Homeland Security and also an incident response truck, as well as a large pavilion where ICE agents and prosecutors had set up like a command center. And then at the bottom, there was gymnasium-type building where the approximately 300 detainees, male detainees, were being kept. The women had been held in county jails at some distance from Waterloo, Iowa, which is where court proceedings took place. Waterloo is about maybe an hour and a half drive from Postville.
And at that point, did the males know if their wives or where they had gone, if they had been taken?
I don't think that they knew very much of anything. Apparently, the whole thing, you know, happened fairly fast, you know, in the middle of panic. So I don't think that they knew very much. Also, their families, in many instances, whether it was in Iowa or back their home countries, Guatemala or Mexico, in many cases did not know what had happened to their relatives in Iowa. In some cases, some of them did not want their families to find out because they didn't want them to worry. In other cases, they did, but, you know, at that point, they had not had a chance to really get in touch with them. So, mm-hmm. You know, there was quite a bit of a lack of communication, and of course, they were not in a position where they could easily make a phone call. So, yes, they didn't know very much about what was going on.
You really didn't know that much about what had gone on at this point either, did you?
No, not at all. Basically, we just started going through the hearings, which were basically initial appearances where they charge the detainees. They tell them what they're accused of. They're very repetitive proceedings. You don't find out very much at all. I really started finding out more when I got back to the hotel room that evening and I started looking on television and searching the web. And the very first report in the local media started coming out in the next few days. But one thing that struck me was that for many, many days, there was practically no national coverage on an event of this magnitude. So it was a source of concern. Basically, cameras were not allowed past the perimeter of the compound.
Now, is it normal for you to do a report like that when you finish with a case like this?
Well, let me put it this way. In 23 years of professional practice, I have never spoken out about any case whatsoever. I have never made any reports, never issued any public comments or statements. That underscores how exceptional this situation was. This was nothing like I had ever been exposed to before. And basically, my writing about it started with a need to debrief, I guess, after what I consider was a very traumatic experience, being placed in a position where my ethics, my personal ethics were compromised, and where basically I had to go and do my job and finish my job. And then when I got home, I just carried this horrible sense of guilt for having participated in what I thought was a cruel and shameful travesty of justice.
Describe what happened.
The first day of court started, like I said, with a quick tour of the premises. They had, you know, very, very tight security. There were many, many ICE agents and U.S. Marshals.
This means armed?
Yes. In fact, they're one of the trailers and also part of the pavilion were designed as or were set aside as arsenals. And then there was like another building where like a warehouse type building where they had built inside like this wood partition cubicles surrounded by chain link fence that went almost all the way to the ceiling. Those were designed as rooms for the attorneys to meet with their clients before arraignment. But, you know, there was little time to meet with so many clients, and there was also a little privacy because of the constant presence of agents. So then, basically, we got ready to interpret the proceedings in the courtroom, and then they started bringing in the defendants, and they were brought in groups of 10, single file, and they were shackled to their waist and wrists and ankles, and they were kind of like shuffling in, and they sat them in a row of chairs right there at the court, and they proceeded to arraign them. And, you know, it was a little bit striking, first of all, that they were being brought in mass like that, 10 at a time, because these were individual cases. Mm-hmm. Each one had a different case number. So on paper, it was almost as though they were being individually prosecuted, but in practice, they were prosecuted in groups. And that, of course, raises all sorts of problems, because the different defendants may have different circumstances, different levels of responsibility. So there's a conflict of interest. charging them together and in prosecuting them together.
And could you tell if there was any rationale or rational decision made around the 10 that were brought in at one time? Were they all, for example, under the Social Security number charge, or were they? Was there any commonality that would make sense?
Not at all. Not at all. What happened was that day, ICE had a barcode system for handling all the documents for each defendant, and the barcode system malfunctioned. So then they started in that big pavilion that they had, they started by hand spreading out all the documents, putting them all together, everything that went together with what, and basically as they had a group of them ready, they started bringing them in. So it was just a random, because the whole thing happened so fast, and that, you know, it would have been impossible to do a more logical order of a certain type or of a certain charge or with certain circumstances or who had a certain type of document to be brought together. Mm-hmm. There wasn't really any time for the agents to interview 306 defendants.
Mm-hmm. 10 defendants came in, and how many interpreters were servicing those 10?
We had more interpreters than we needed at that point because of the delay. They only were able to bring in 4 groups the first day. So we had 3 interpreters in each hearing. One interpreter would speak into the microphone, and that would go through headsets to each of the defendants. Then another interpreter would interpret any answers from the defendants whenever they were asked questions. Mm. And then there was a third standby interpreter next to the defendants just to make sure that, since there was a row of 10, just to make sure that their answers could be heard. Things got a lot busier later, but
yeah.
That's how it started. One of the things that was striking about the initial appearance or the arraignment is that the magistrate would tell them all the different rights that they had and that they have the presumption of innocence. And it was very awkward because here you are telling people who are shackled and who are being fast-tracked and who have no opportunity to mention their individual circumstances, that they have the presumption of innocence. It was very odd. It was a meaningless statement and very unbelievable to them and to everybody else, actually, because they didn't even have a right of bail, which was the next thing that struck me. There was an immigration detainer against them. So when the question of bail came up, the magistrate said, well, I understand there's an immigration detainer, so I'm going to order them detained, and there's not going to be a bail hearing. And that's very, very significant because, as you know, all defendants in the criminal justice system have a right to a bail hearing. They may be denied bail, but at least they have a right to a bail hearing. Mm-hmm. Now, in this case, they didn't because of an immigration detainer that was underlying the criminal case. And that's very problematic because basically it denies their Sixth Amendment right to reasonable bail. And what happened was that the fact that they had no right of bail later on became very significant because when they were offered their plea agreement, the offer that the government was making was to either plead guilty to Social Security fraud, and then they would withdraw the heavier charge of identity theft. And the defendants would accept 5 months in jail and then deportation without a hearing thereafter. If they decided to plead not guilty, then they would have to wait 6 to 8 months for a trial. Now, normally, you know, defendants post bail, they wait their 6 to 8 months, and in the meantime, they're working or they're doing whatever they need to do to support their families. In this case, they had no right of bail. So pleading not guilty meant waiting longer than the recommended sentence in jail without the right of mail, and without being able to support their families. And of course, these people were very, very needy people. They are really the poor of the poor. So their families were in jeopardy. And as a matter of fact, right now, the reports that I've read recently are that some of these families back in Guatemala are suffering severe malnutrition because of having their sole earners in jail for several months. And that's exactly what they were afraid of. You know, these people were completely mortified by the thought of their families, you know, how they were going to make it. You know, it was a very, very cruel set of circumstances that was imposed on them that completely violated their constitutional rights, because every person who comes into the criminal justice system, into our courts, regardless whether they're legal or not in this country, they have constitutional rights. Everybody has equality under the law. This is something that is a very, very old doctrine that has been upheld by the Supreme Court many, many times. So it's an unquestionable issue. You know, some people believe that, hey, these people are illegal aliens. They have no rights, and that's not correct.
This is Raising San Radio on KZSU Stanford, and today we're talking to Dr. Eric Kamaid, an interpreter who worked with over 300 undocumented workers arrested in a surprise raid in Postville, Iowa earlier this year. I asked Dr. Kamaid when he began having misgivings about the process he was involved in.
Well, from the very beginning, I saw that there was no meaningful presumption of innocence and that bail rights were being denied. So that was something that made me raise an eyebrow. But then after the detainees were arraigned, they were immediately bused to different jails throughout Iowa. And in the next few days, the interpreters with the attorneys paired up to go and find their clients and visit them in jail, in order to present the plea agreement that the government was offering. So that brought us into direct personal contact, one-on-one, with each of these defendants, and we were able to see their particular stories. Now, this is a type of contact that judges and prosecutors never get to experience. When we met individually with these defendants in jail, I saw the predicament they were in, where basically we explained the plea agreement and they had to choose between pleading guilty and accepting 5 months in jail for Social Security fraud, and then have the heavier charge of aggravated identity theft withdrawn. The significance of that is that the identity theft charge carries a mandatory minimum 2-year sentence. So that was kind of like the leverage to get them to plead guilty to the lesser charge. The lesser charge by itself, Social Security fraud or use of false documents, had a discretionary sentence of 0 to 6 months or more, but it was at the discretion of the judge. If they pleaded not guilty, then they would have to wait 6 to 8 months in jail without any right of bail for a trial, which they may lose. And if they lost the trial, they would get 2 to 5 years in jail. Mm-hmm. And even if they won the trial, they would still be deported, and they would have spent longer in jail than if they just pled guilty. So the whole thing, the lack of bail and the identity theft charge, which, you know, was a groundless charge, basically put them in a position where they had no choice but to plead guilty. And the fact that their family's survival was in jeopardy made these pleas coerced, basically.
And how did the lawyers react to this?
The lawyers were incredibly frustrated. The lawyers were just, you know, looking for some avenue to some kind of defense strategy that they could present, but there was none. So they were, you know, very, very frustrated and many times on the verge of tears. Mm. It was, you know, something that affected me because I saw that my own misgivings were being confirmed, you know, by the reaction of the lawyers, and later by the reactions of a judge. Now, during these jail interviews, then I was able to see that five out of nine defendants that we interviewed one by one that weekend didn't know what a Social Security number was or what it was used for. In some cases, they didn't know how to read and write, and basically they filled out the papers for them at the plant.
You know, one of the people had walked from Guatemala to Iowa. So how do they know that there's work available at this processing plant?
It was common knowledge. This was a man who had walked all through Mexico from Guatemala. It took him 40 days to basically cross Mexico on foot. And then he crossed the river, as he said, alone. Then once in the United States, he met up with other immigrants, and he hitchhiked on a truck to Dallas. And there, basically, the word among the immigrants that were looking for work was that there was sure work in Iowa.
Okay.
So then they hitchhiked, again, other trucks all the way to Postville. Uh-huh. And then he basically got there. He started sleeping on a hallway of an apartment together with other immigrants on the floor until he was able to start work and basically pay for his own lodging and so forth. Mm. He first went to the plant to seek work empty-handed, and they told him, you have to go back and get some papers. So he walked out, and he said that out in the street there was a Mexican fellow who told him that he could get him some papers. And in this case, he paid $90. They took his picture, and they gave him some papers some days later. They didn't tell him anything about the papers, whether there was an identity that belonged to somebody else. Mm. He absolutely knew nothing about that. He was just, you know, getting papers to work with. He was not aware of doing anything wrong to anybody. Other people paid upwards of $300 for the papers, $300, $350. Again, they were just told, okay, here are the papers, and not really given any explanation of what the papers were or anything else. They were aware that they were not government papers, but they were not aware of what a Social Security number was or the fact that these were identities that belonged to somebody else. They only used them for being able to get work. Now, these people are also victims of the false document cartel, which is a ring of organized crime. Every few months, they would ask him to get new papers. They would say, well, you know, you need new papers. Those are not good anymore, so here you go. Pay another $300 or $350. Mm. And they kept them in that vicious circle.
This is a kosher meat processing plant. The owners were completely surprised that this was going on. They didn't know that their workers were from Guatemala, for example.
Well, you know, of course, they're claiming ignorance. The truth of the matter is that 76% of their workforce was illegal.
And they were paid minimum wage?
They were paid minimum wage and sometimes less, sometimes $5, $6 an hour. They were also not paid overtime regularly,
right.
Even though they had to work sometimes up to 17 hours a day for 6 days. In fact, there was a minor, a 16-year-old boy, who was working 17 hours a day, 6 days a week, and he described it as feeling like he was a slave. So, going back to this individual case, this man who walked from Guatemala to the United States, crossing Mexico and crossing the river, he had several children, his mother, his wife, and his sister. back in Guatemala, all depending on him, on the money that he was able to send back. He said that his idea was to come to the United States and work for a year or two, save some money, and go back home to his family and get something started, you know, buy a truck or get something started. He had only been working a couple of months when he was picked up. Mm-hmm. So he basically felt that he had failed his family. Mm-hmm. And he was, you know, very, very distressed. This was our first interview, and it lasted 3 hours. Mm-hmm. And most of those 3 hours, this man just wept right there on the table at a crowded visiting room in the jail. And he was just unable to understand the charges, first of all, mm-hmm. or the rights that he was giving up, mm-hmm. and unable to understand why he was being put in jail when he had not come here to do harm to anybody. Mm-hmm. He had just come here to work. He kept saying, I know I'm illegal in this country. I have no rights. I'm nobody. He was not going to plead not guilty and go to a trial because he thought that he stood no chance of winning a trial. He thought that he would be condemned from the start. And many others felt that way as well. The fact of the matter is that the way this fast-tracking process was done, the lawyers were put in the position of being the bearer of bad news, basically going to jail to meet with the defendants and present the government's deal, which was no deal at all. So many of them, and this man in particular, distrusted his own lawyer, and he distrusted the interpreters. Hmm. He thought that his lawyer and the interpreters were just part of the system, keeping him in jail and keeping him from supporting his family. Mm-hmm. And I could see, you know, I could see why he felt that way. And, you know, I could also see in the lawyer who actually volunteered to do this and help these people that, you know, it was a very emotional moral conflict. Mm. Because, you know, the lawyer was doing everything possible to help the client, but at the same time had to understand how the client felt and had to just take a big swallow and respect that and take it and forge ahead the best way possible. Now, it was also interesting that this lawyer saw that also that the clients were possibly not guilty because they didn't know what a social security number was, and the charges... part of the elements of the charge was knowingly and with intent to deceive. So if they had no knowledge of the Social Security number or how it all worked, there was no possible intent. And therefore, the lawyer tried to get what is called an Alford plea, which enables the defendant to take the offer that the government is making just because it's in their best interest, it's just the best option given the options that they have, but mm-hmm. without having to say under oath, yes, I'm guilty of knowingly and with intent to deceive, presenting false documents, etc. The request for the Alford plea was rejected, and there were other lawyers also who wanted to make that request. It was rejected by the prosecution. They said that they had no local discretion to make any changes to the plea agreement, that the plea agreement was chiseled out at the Department of Justice in Washington, and the DOJ was not about to make any case-by-case exception when so many defendants were being fast-tracked. This was another instance in which the individual circumstances of each case were not taken into consideration. Basically, the fast-tracking process gives the same deal to everybody.
And this is it sounds like a template for future actions just like this one.
Oh, yes, absolutely. One of the things that made it a moral imperative for me to write my report was that the Postville raid and the judicial case that followed in Waterloo, Iowa, was a pilot project to be replicated again and again. Mm-hmm. What had happened, in fact, was that a charge of aggravated identity theft was a charge that was created by an act of Congress in 1998, and it was meant for the people who steal identities in order to get credit under somebody else's name and thereby steal thousands and thousands of dollars, sometimes through credit card or other types of credit. Something very different from this. Now, what happened is that in the middle of 2007, ICE prosecutors came up with the idea, and evidently they convinced some U.S. attorneys to do this, to charge some of the illegal workers with aggravated identity theft. And they did it at a very small scale, you know, a case here, a case there, since the middle of 2007, sort of like testing the waters, you know. And it worked in those cases, so then they decided to apply it wholesale in the Postville case. So this was definitely a template. It was a pilot operation to be then replicated at a mass scale throughout the country.
So within about a week, they processed about 400 people in this fast track.
That's right, in between 4 and 10 days.
Do you know what's the dispensation of any of these people at this point? Have you been able to stay in touch with what's going on with them?
Yes, indirectly. I have been in touch with some of the religious relief workers in Postville because I was very, very concerned for the well-being of the families back in Guatemala. I knew that the families in Postville, they were local, so they were being looked after, but I was afraid that the families in Guatemala would fall through the cracks, and in fact they have. I then contacted relief workers in Postville, and in particular Reverend David Vasquez, who's a pastor at Luther College. He told me that, in fact, they had 3 volunteers full-time on the phone trying to track down where these prisoners were. And good number of them, roughly about half of them, were not to be found because they were in transit, so they did not appear in the Board of Prisons website. The number that the U.S. Marshal's Office had given, you know, for families to find out their whereabouts was not helpful at all. And there were no federal prisons in Iowa, so many of these prisoners were taken out of state. Many of them have not been able to be tracked down. Yeah. And then to top it all off, because of the floods that happened in the area in Iowa a couple of weeks, starting a few weeks after the raid, there were some prisons that actually had to be evacuated and the prisoners redistributed because of the flooding. Many of these people, nobody knows where they are. They can't locate them because the idea was to locate them and see, you know, what their family circumstance was, if they needed help back in Guatemala, and then to be able to send a little something. You know, you send $200 to a family, they can survive for 5-6 months.
Right.
So it was something that was financially very feasible to do, but in practical terms, very difficult to find these people. And then Reverend Vasquez told me that, in fact, they had their hands full in Postville. They had a major, they still do, humanitarian crisis there. Basically, that's what happened. The reports that I've had recently from people, indigenous groups, who have been in Guatemala, is that some of these families are, in fact, suffering hardship and malnutrition. Mm. Also been informed by the ambassador of Guatemala that some of them mortgaged whatever they had in order to raise some money for their trip to the United States. And now that they're in jail, the loan sharks in Guatemala are going after the families and taking whatever they have.
I think it's really important what you're telling us here, because it's not just a local event. This is the way the world is so integrated. You know, you touch something here and something on the other side is going to be affected too. And I think that's one of the things that we're not really totally cognizant of enough.
It's really incredible. What Postville is a poster town for globalization. just the whole history of the town, there have been immigrants from so many different parts of the world who have become part of the fabric of society in this small town. Even now, when the plant was lacking workers, they were desperate to find workers. Well, they bussed some homeless people from Texas, and the results were terrible because crime went through the roof in this small town. Some of these people didn't last. Some of them were shipped back as undesirables. And then recently they bussed about 150 Somali refugees from Minnesota, and some of them did not like the conditions at all and left. Others are sticking it out and seeing if they can, you know, get settled so that they can then send for their families. So Postville is really a microcosm of globalization, of what's going on also in the rest of the country in terms of this immigration crisis that we have.
And when you read the statements of people in the residents of Postville, they talk about the trauma that they've gone through. The schools may be closing down because of the children being so affected, and it just, there's this ripple effect, I think, that you're pointing out here.
Susan, as soon as I send my essay out to my colleague interpreters who worked the case with me, and I also sent it to a federal judge, they started asking me for permission to distribute to their friends and family, and I waited to make sure that the judge didn't have a problem with it. So as soon as I gave them permission to do that, I started receiving hundreds and hundreds of emails from all over the country and eventually from all over the world of people thanking me for doing this. Some of the most moving ones were from Postville, just regular citizens of Postville, just trying to understand why this happened to their town, and saying how they're glad that at least people are speaking out about it, because that way future generations will be able to look back upon this with disbelief and shame. Mm-hmm. And I am quoting textually a letter from a sewer worker in Postville who wrote to me and said, you know, I'm just very, very ashamed. And I wrote back to him and I said, well, take heart in the fact that, you know, decent Americans have not and will not look the other way. And he wrote back to me and said, you know what, you're right. And I'm very proud to see fourth generation Germans and high school kids helping with the families there, with the children, bringing food, bringing clothing, volunteering in the relief effort. So it brings the worst and the best out of mankind. I also, you know, received letters from Postville from small farmers, family farm owners, who say, you know, this is just ridiculous. These people were good people. They were good workers. They were family people. We need them. We need immigrant labor for our farms to survive. So this is a disaster of egregious proportions for all concerned.
Well, you've gone on to create the moratorium on worksite enforcement raid statement also.
Yes. What happened was that I was invited to a Latino labor movement convention on August 5th. And there I spoke about the different things that affect the labor movement and workers in general. I ended up by calling for a moratorium on raids, and I asked the different unions to draft a resolution asking for Congress to declare a moratorium on raids, and they have. They've drafted a very, very strong resolution to that effect. The reason for calling for a moratorium, and by the way, I'm not the only one. There are many, many people and many, many groups asking for a moratorium right now, but as I understand it, the main reason is that Congress failed to pass immigration reform, so they left a legal vacuum, and that legal vacuum is being filled by ICE, basically implementing their own brand of immigration reform without congressional approval, because the extent to which the raids have incremented since 2006, they amount to a change in policy. They amount to what is basically a huge paramilitary operations against foreign nationals inside our borders. And it's appalling that something like that can happen in a democracy without discussion and vote by our elected officials, without congressional approval. Basically, the raids are taking place in a legal vacuum, mm-hmm. pursuant to a system of laws and an immigration system that everybody agrees is broken. So it's irresponsible to continue with these operations based on a broken system of laws. The idea of a moratorium is to give Congress the time to look at these issues, to get a grip over immigration reform, then have enforcement, but enforcement that is authorized. Logically, first comes immigration reform, then comes authorized immigration enforcement. Mm-hmm. There are some people in Congress who think that is the other way around, or they claim that the American people will never admit of immigration reform if first there is an immigration enforcement. And I think that's just sheer demagoguery.
In fact, if you go to the Homeland Security website and the ICE website, what you'll see there is a presentation of numbers. We've done so many raids, we've arrested so many people. We on the Homeland Security, we have so many miles of fence now on the border. It's all about numbers, and lost in the cracks is exactly what you're talking about here, the actual human beings that are being affected by this.
Exactly. Well, you know, the importance of those numbers is that those statistics translate into higher budgets year after year. You know, right now, in 2008, we have already surpassed the number of arrests in worksite raids that we had in 2007. Mm-hmm. So as a result, these statistics are going to serve to bolster ICE's budget next year and basically follow the money and
you'll see
how it all works. But in particular, you know, all of these documents, particularly the ICE 2007 annual report, they're very, very revealing. Part of what I did in my essay was analyze these documents because you know, I'm trained as a discourse analyst. I analyze texts. That's what I do for a living. And these texts are not particularly hard to deconstruct. So I pick them apart, and basically I take the official jargon that they present, and I can show what the true agenda is. I can compare what they say with what they do, in particular in the post-bill raid, and basically expose the contradictions there. You know, ICE's mission is to target criminal aliens and fugitive aliens, not regular workers, and certainly not turn regular workers somehow magically into criminal aliens just because you charge them with identity theft. They go to a work site and they hit several hundred people, so right. It's like, you know, hitting a small jackpot. There are reports of ICE waiting, for example, for people to go to church and picking them up on the way to church. So it's not only work sites, although work sites are the prime target because they yield abundant numbers, you know, to feed these statistics. Also, ICE has deputized hundreds of local police stations and sheriff offices throughout the country to do immigration enforcement. Basically, you have this network that sets neighbor against neighbor because, I mean, these police officers are our neighbors. Divides the country in a very, very dangerous way, mm-hmm. and it creates a system of vigilance that is not unlike those that have been practiced in totalitarian regimes. One thing that this whole case brought to mind is that, to me, Americans who were born here take democracy for granted, and democracy is something that you have to preserve and fight for every day. And the reason I spoke about this whole thing was not in defense of the immigrants. It could have been a different group. They just happened to be immigrants. But I spoke for democracy. Mm-hmm. I spoke for constitutional rights and for the rights of due process, regardless of which group was affected.
Right.
Because, you know, it was my job to do that as an officer of the court. It's a matter of conscience, you know. This is something that, the same way that it affected me, you know, when you see it up close, it affects anybody, anybody who has a conscience. It's easy for a prosecutor or a judge who doesn't have that one-on-one contact with detainees in jail like the attorneys and the interpreters did. It's easy for them to accuse and to condemn because they don't have to bear the brunt of, you know, human suffering. And they don't have to see the individual cases. In fact, in the Postville process, they did everything possible to keep the individual plight of these 306 detainees to come up publicly in court to be heard. So basically, they were all mass prosecuted, and the same thing was applied, same procedure, the same plea agreement, everything.
That was Dr. Eric Kamade on his experiences as an interpreter for undocumented workers arrested in Postville, Iowa. Dr. Kamade reports that many people have asked him how they can help. One way is to donate to the National Immigration Bond Fund that seeks to reaffirm the values of dignity and due process by assisting immigrants swept up in immigration and custom enforcement actions. It helps them to post bond quickly in order to secure a fair hearing in America's courts. You can learn more about this bond by doing a search on the internet under National Immigration Bond Fund or going to www.publicinterestprojects.org. If you want to help the victims in Postville, Iowa, you can get in touch with St. Bridget's Church, 141 West William Street, Postville, Iowa, 52162, or you can call the church at area code 563-864-3142. Again, that's St. Bridget's Church, 141 West William Street, Postville, Iowa, 52162, or call 563-864-3142. Now, I'd also like to share a letter written by a defense attorney, Rockney Cole, who declined to continue in the legal process at Postville. This letter went to Representative Zoe Lofgren. May 12th began like any other day. I arrived at the office and began reading my email. At about 9:30, my partner knocked on the door and told me the raids have begun and the black helicopters are flying over Postville. Homeland Security officials had rented the Cattle Congress several weeks before, but no one knew when or where the raids would take place. We anticipated that the raid would probably proceed that like the Swift Plant packing raid in Marshalltown, Iowa last year. I then checked the internet, looked at the initial photos, and went back to work. A short time later, a clerk in the Northern District of Iowa called me. Ms. Pickens used to be appointment clerk for Criminal Justice Act appointments for the federal courts in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Ms. Pickens told me that there was going to be a special meeting at the United States District Courthouse in Cedar Rapids at 1:30 that afternoon and that I should not tell anyone about the meeting. So I drove up to Cedar Rapids to see what the meeting was about. I went up to the main courtroom on the third floor and saw approximately 10 to 15 defense lawyers whom I knew to be on the Criminal Justice Act panel in Cedar Rapids. I also saw Assistant United States Attorney Stephanie Rose, the Chief Clerk of Court Robert Phelps, some United States Marshals, and I believe some probation officials. At some point early in the presentation, Chief Clerk Phelps handed out what I can only characterize as guilty plea handbooks. These handbooks described all the elements of offenses and essentially contained a book of waivers of various rights of the defendants. Mr. Phelps also passed around a sign-up sheet with requests for our cell phones and email addresses. Ayusa Rose began the meeting by scanning the audience for media officials. After she determined that none were present, she began the presentation. She immediately began discussing the so-called representation plan. She indicated each attorney would be assigned a group consisting of 10 clients. She indicated that we would be expected to represent up to 40 defendants, and they were expecting possibly 700 defendants. As it turns out, I believe the Des Moines Register confirmed an average of 17 clients per attorney. She then described the four possible plea deals being offered to each group. The first deal was a plea to a felony, I do not recall which, an immediate placement in the custody of Bureau of Immigration and Customs Enforcement. So in other words, the defendant was offered no jail time, but the client would have a felony in the record. The second deal, and apparently most common, was a five-month jail sentence to be followed by immediate deportation to their home countries. The third category was 12 months and one day. I believe the fourth category was reserved for defendants with significant aggravating facts, such as prior aggravated felonies or violent histories. I do not recall the specific felony that they had to plead to, but all the felonies were basically some variation on the use of a forged identity card to get a job. At one point, I asked if she'd considered that any of the defendants were innocent. She replied that they could opt out and proceed on the regular docket if they wanted to. I do not recall at the time whether she indicated the United States was threatening an aggravated identity theft charge if they opted out. I have subsequently learned that any defendant refusing such a deal could face an aggravated identity theft. My next question focuses on the pre-sentence investigation reports. I have probably represented about five to several federal defendants on fake paper charges in the past. In the typical case, the client had entered without inspection and consequently had no legal status in the United States to protect. They often had already admitted to possession of a fake identification document, and consequently such cases were difficult to defend. Most resulted in time-served plea deals. In those simple cases, we had often complained to probation about why they needed to do a full pre-sentence investigation report on the defendants if they chose to get deported as soon as possible. In fact, at one conference last year, the United States District Court Judge John Jarvie even told one of the probation officers that a full pre-sentence report was not necessary in the run-of-the-mill case. The United States Attorney Office and the Probation Office had often strongly resisted waiver of pre-sentence report on two grounds. First, they did not want to miss prior criminal convictions, which can increase the prison sentence. Secondly, the Probation Office did not get full credit for an abbreviated pre-sentence report, so they wanted to do a full pre-sentence report to keep their funding up for more probation staffing. I asked Ms. Rose how they could be doing such a quick guilty plea process when they had so strenuously resisted abbreviated reports in the past. I asked her why they were not concerned about missing criminal convictions as they had in the past. She replied that these were Rule 11C1C plea deals. In the typical plea deal, the court is not bound by the sentencing recommendations of each party. She is only limited by the statutory maximum penalty and the advisory sentencing guidelines. A Rule 11C1C allows the court to be bound to the sentencing recommendations of the United States and defendant. At the guilty plea hearing, the court notifies the parties if she will accept the guilty plea, and if she does, she is bound to the sentencing recommendations of the parties. If not, the defendant can withdraw the appeal. This effectively guarantees that the defendant will get the agreed-upon sentence on the plea bargain and avoid the risk of a longer sentence before the judge. What I found most astonishing is that apparently Chief Judge Linda Reed had already ratified these deals prior to one lawyer even talking to his or her client. Judge Reed's presence at the meeting seemed to confirm as much. This directly violates Rule 11 plea procedure, which provides that the court must not participate in these plea discussions. Moreover, this ratification appeared to be ex parte with the United States Attorney Office. Indeed, it had to have been ex parte because no lawyers had even met with their clients prior to these Rule 11C1C plea bargains being announced. Ms. Rose concluded by stating that the plea hearings would begin by Saturday, May 17, 2008, and that the clients would have 7 days to accept the offer. She justified the quick timeline because they were concerned about getting the defendants back to their families in Guatemala as soon as possible. Especially considering this extremely rushed process, I realized that the acceptance of such an appointment would have required me to immediately report myself to the Iowa Bar Association for failing to protect a client's right to conflict-free counsel. Iowa Rule of Professional Responsibility 32.1.7a and b provides that the lawyer shall not represent a client if there is a significant risk of conflict, and that any consent to conflict shall be in writing. The potential conflicts were obvious. For example, suppose, under the group representation plan, that the attorney simultaneously represents a woman with a Violence Against Women Act adjustment case against her husband, and her husband in a different group. In this situation, the wife may have a good claim to adjust status and remain in the United States on the basis of her status as a victim of domestic violence. Her husband will likely be prosecuted for domestic abuse and could be deported on the basis of being the abuser. Their interests directly conflict. Other examples come to mind. What if one of the workers helped the other to obtain the false paper? That person would certainly be a witness for either the defense or the United States. Moreover, if such potential conflict existed, the Sixth Amendment compels disclosure to the court and on the record colloquy by the district court to ensure the client's right to conflict-free counsel. You can see Holloway versus Arkansas 435 U.S. 475-485-486 from 1978. Defense attorneys have the obligation upon discovering a conflict of interest to advise the court at once of the problem. Under these circumstances, it would have been impossible to meaningfully assess conflict of interest issues in 7 days. After that, Ms. Rose described the plea deals. A United States Marshal began describing the Orwellian security plan. Each attorney accepting an appointment had to arrive early the following day at the Cattle Congress for processing and to obtain a photo ID card. I think these cards were similar to a necklace-type press credential. He then told us that attorneys would be able to meet with clients in a designated representation zone. He indicated that each attorney could not walk around Cattle Congress grounds without an escort by the United States Marshal. He also advised us of an evacuation plan in case of any disturbance. At that point, I felt that I could not participate in the mass violation of rights. I informed Mr. Phelps that I would not be participating, and he said, "Okay, please turn in your please turn in your three-ring binder." I then walked out in disgust. Chief Judge Reed was there for at least 10 minutes. I do not recall at which point she left. I think at some point Ms. Stephanie Rose advised her there would be a good time to leave as people began asking about the detail of these deals. Obviously, I'm fairly reluctant to openly criticize Judge Reed. I have pretty much resigned myself to not taking any more appointments in her district. However, in spite of the financial repercussions for taking this position, I simply could not stay silent on this issue. The clerk of court issued a press release talking about the roundup of illegal aliens. This process, presumed guilt, deprived defendants of their right to due process and interfered with their basic right to choose their own counsel. The court-appointed attorney's role appeared to be only to act as a guilty plea processing clerk and serve only to expedite the mass waiver of rights. From what I can infer based upon the facts from the initial meeting as well as subsequent media reports, Judge Reed and the United States Attorney's Office coordinated the mass detention, roundup, representation plan, plea plans, and sentencing prior to one single attorney consulting with the client. I hope I'm wrong about that inference, but the overwhelming facts suggest a breathtaking level of coordination between the United States District Court Judge and the Department of Justice. I nevertheless strongly encourage the committee to keep an open mind and to afford all levels involved a fair hearing, which unfortunately was not given to the defendants in Postville. It is signed by Rock Nicole. And again, this is a letter to Representative Zoe Lofgren on the May 12, 2008 Postville immigration raids by Rock Nicole, a lawyer who declined to participate in the proceedings. You can find other documents on the Raising Sand website at www.raisingsandradio.org, including the essay that Dr. Kamayad references on his experiences. He sent his essay to the Subcommittee on Immigration, Citizenship, Refugees, Border Security, and International Law at the District Court for the Northern District of Iowa, and that seemed to get a lot of people involved in this thing. Also, there are on the Raising Sand website links to the various other documents handed out to the defense attorneys at the meeting Rock Nicole attended. This includes the script for initial appearances, as well as what Cole in his letter calls the guilty plea handbooks. On a further note, the legal community has scrutinized the overall process described here and has petitioned the Supreme Court to re-examine the charge of aggravated identity theft. And from Rhode Island, we have Rhode Island's Roman Catholic Bishop Thomas Tobin calling on the U.S. authorities to halt mass immigration raids and says agents who refuse to participate in such raids on moral grounds deserve to be treated as conscientious objectors. He asks for a blanket moratorium on immigration raids in Rhode Island until the nation adopts comprehensive immigration reform. Thanks for listening to Raising Sand Radio on KZSU Stanford. And as always, you can email me at susan@raisingsandradio.org. Views expressed here are those of the hosts and guests and not KZSU or Stanford University. And music today by Willie King, Terrorized.